You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. November is quickly approaching and control of Congress is up for grabs. What will be the state of play in the U.S. Senate and House, as well as the gubernatorial races? The real drama in this cycle will be the battle for control of the Senate, where Republicans need to win a net gain of 6 seats to win a majority in Congress's upper chamber. Jeffrey Skelly joined the staff of the Center for Politics in November 2011. Working as a political analyst, Skelly is the associate editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball, the Center's weekly political newsletter. He also serves as the Center's media relations coordinator, helping manage its communications. A native of Harrisonburg, Virginia, Skelly received an M.A. in political science from James Madison University in 2011, and is a graduate from the University of Virginia, receiving a B.A. in history in 2009. Mr. Skelly spoke at the Wednesday, October 8, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Bob McGrath. Our podcast is entitled, What's the Outlook for the 2014 midterm elections? Here's Bob McGrath.
My name is Bob McGrath. I'm president of Senior Statesmen of Virginia. I have this blue name tag on. If any of you are not yet members of Senior Statesmen and you would like to be, it's easy to do. And the first step would be to just find one of us around the room wearing these badges and just ask them what being a member does for you and how you can become one. Now, I'm going to be the moderator for today's program. And what that means is that I'm going to briefly introduce our speaker. And then at the end of his remarks, we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers. And the usual drill is that because these sessions are podcast, we'll have people with microphones, and don't ask a question unless you're armed with a microphone, okay? So our speaker today is Jeffrey Skelly. He joined the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia in 2011. He works as a political analyst, and he's the associate editor of Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, the Center's weekly political newsletter. He also serves as the Center Media Relations Coordinator, helping manage its communications. He's a native of Harrisonburg, Virginia. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia. He has a BA in history from Virginia. He then took a master's degree in political science with a focus on the European Union. From James Madison University after his BA here at Virginia. We're very pleased that he can be here with us today to tell us exactly what the election outcome will be in November. So, Jeffrey, please.
Unfortunately, I don't think I can tell you exactly what will happen, but I think I can give you a good overview of the state of play, if you will, the environment that this election will be taking place in, and kind of an overview of the races, particularly the Senate, which is where I think most of the drama is in this election cycle. And so I'm just going to jump right in. The crystal ball. What will happen? So this is the kind of the status quo here at the moment. Republicans have a very large majority in the House. There are three vacancies, but they have a 34-seat edge. And in the Senate, Democrats hold a 10-seat edge, which means that Republicans, in order to take back the Senate, have to gain 6 seats. So I guess in a sense, it's Democrats have a 5-seat edge because every time there's a flip, it's kind of like plus two on one side, or, well, net-wise. So anyway, 6 seats for Republicans to take back the Senate. And just kind of moving on from there, I think the most important thing that's going on in this election, I get asked a lot, what's the most important issue in this election? Well, there have been a lot of articles about this, but there really isn't one driving issue. in this contest. There's not one thing that overhangs. You know, you can go back to 2008 and the economy clearly was the number one issue. In 2010, the economy and the Health Care Act, huge issues. 2012, probably the economy again. This election, though, it's kind of reaching into all kinds of things. You've got foreign policy with the stuff going on in the Middle East. You've got immigration. You've still got the healthcare law. You've got the economy still, because it's still not fully ramped up by any means. But it is doing better, at least according to statistics, though a lot of people don't seem to feel it. So there's just it's kind of a muddle. And so really, at the end of the day, the most important aspect of this election is President Obama, even though his name isn't on the ticket, because there's some historical and just kind of basic political factors behind this. First, the president's party very rarely does well in a midterm election. And I think that basically comes down to the fact that the people who are most engaged in a midterm election, most likely to vote, are probably those who are most dissatisfied with the political status quo. And in this case, that'd be Republican voters, because Democrats control the White House. So with that in mind, in the last 25 midterm elections, only three times has the president's party gained seats in the House. And the House is usually a better national barometer of feeling, because the Senate is more geographical and races are more idiosyncratic because they're statewide elections. And only a third of the Senate is up every 2 years because they have staggered terms. So usually we talk about the House and we talk about what does the country feel like at the moment? Who are they supporting? Who are they opposing? And, you know, we can look back at the 2010 midterm election, see a good example of that, you know, real backlash to the Obama administration. Republicans ended up winning a net 63 seats in the House, you know, huge wave, one of the largest historically. And so that isn't going to happen this time around, but the president's approval rating is in the low 40s, and that doesn't bode well for Democrats in the midterm election. So the only three times where Democrats actually managed to add seats in the House, or excuse me, presidents managed to add seats, were in 1934, right after the start of the New Deal. The Republican label was completely in the toilet at that point, so Democrats actually managed to add some seats. In 1998, Republicans overreached in trying to impeach Bill Clinton, and there was some backlash because of that, and Democrats actually ended up adding a few seats in the House. And in 2002, George W. Bush's approval rating was very high, and there was kind of a rally around the flag effect going on in the aftermath of 9/11, and Republicans ended up adding a few seats. And so those are the only three examples in the last 25 midterms where a president's party actually gained seats in the House. So that probably tells us that Democrats aren't going to be able to win back the House in 2014. At the moment, this is kind of an overview of what's going on in the House. At the moment, we think that Republicans are probably going to add somewhere between 5 and 8 seats. They might reach low double digits. And that's basically because of the fact, again, that Republicans have an advantage, just natural inherent advantage in the midterm environment. But the reason that it's not a larger number is because, well, partially, Republicans won a ton of seats in 2010, and they've sort of maxed out where they can go. We live in a very polarized era politically, and so once you talk about a seat that Barack Obama won 57-58% of the vote in, that's going to be very hard, even in a Republican-leaning year, for a Republican to actually win. And at the moment, and this is, I think, a good illustration of the polarization that exists in the country, at the moment, out of 435 seats in the U.S. House, only 26 are held by a member of the party that didn't win that seat at the presidential level in 2012. So there are 17 Republicans in the U.S. House who hold seats that Barack Obama won in 2012 at the presidential level, and there are 9 seats that Democrats hold that Mitt Romney won in 2012. And that number is actually going to get smaller, because at least down to 23, because Democrats are heavily favored to win a seat in California that a Republican's retiring in that Barack Obama won. And there's a seat in Utah and a seat in North Carolina that Mitt Romney won by sizable margins that Democrats hold, but both are retiring. And so that number will at least fall to 23, if not further, after this election. And so I always think that's a really good illustration of the polarization going on, and also illustrates why if you're trying to figure out targets, if you're a Democrats or Republicans, for seats to gain, there aren't a lot of marginal seats out there, because partially because of redistricting, but also because of where people choose to live. Democrats are heavily located in urban and suburban areas, and the more rural an area gets, the much more likely it is to be a Republican-leaning area. And so, at the end of the day, there aren't a lot of seats where things are very close politically. Usually it's one way or the other. So not a lot of excitement in terms of the battle for control of the House. Really the only excitement there, I guess, is can Republicans match their post-World War II high of 246 seats, which they won in 1946 in Harry Truman's first midterm. And so they need to win 12. So we think they're going to finish just a little bit short of that at the moment. But at the end of the day, they could match it. Republicans have been using it, a fundraising drive for 245. Rhyming's nice, I guess, for emails. But anyway, they're shooting for 245, so one short of that historical figure. The more interesting thing is obviously the Senate. And a really important factor in all this is geography. So there are 36 seats up in this cycle. And Democrats hold 21 of the 36, and Republicans hold 15. 33 of these are regularly scheduled elections, and 3 are special elections that just happen to be coming up in November. And in 2008, Democrats obviously did very well, and that's one of the main reasons why they hold a majority of these seats. Because actually, this class of senators, the Class 2 map, so Class 1, Class 2, Class 3, the Class 2 map that is up this cycle was actually the most Republican map at the presidential level. If you take all the states that have elections this cycle for the Senate, it's the most Republican map of the three classes. So inherently, Republicans should do well on this map, and Democrats control a majority of these seats. So obviously, there's a lot of opportunity for Republicans to win the 6 seats or more that they need to win a majority. And so if you look at this map, you'll see, especially if I do this and we look at the presidential map, and then I can flip back and forth, you'll see that there's some areas that are red here on the presidential map that are blue, indicating Democrats control them on the Senate map. And there are, in fact, 7 states that Mitt Romney won that have Democratic incumbents that are up this cycle. So you've got Alaska, you've got Montana, you got South Dakota, you got Arkansas, Louisiana, West Virginia, and North Carolina. And so if you're Republicans and you're trying to figure out how do we win 6 seats or at least 6 seats to get a majority, this is a very obvious place to start. Because if they went Republican at the presidential level, that is an indication that fundamentally speaking, they are probably more likely to go Republican in other federal races statewide, like the Senate. Again, this speaks to the polarization that exists in the country. It's very hard for a Democrat or a Republican to win in a state that is heavily going the other way from them. No matter how big a personal appeal you have, there's a fundamental draw there that is very hard to overcome. So moving on into the actual ratings map, which is the fun stuff that I get to do. This is the current situation. At the moment, we have Democrats winning 47 seats, we have Republicans winning 49, and we have 4 toss-ups. And there are some very curious races that have kind of changed the arithmetic for Republicans, and I will get into that in just a moment. But I think the easiest way to go about this is to start and move just kind of we'll start with the toss-ups, because I think that's the easiest thing to do. So we'll start really far out west, Alaska. Far away from the rest of the country, only Hawaii, I guess, is further. But Alaska has a Democrat incumbent named Mark Begich. He was elected in 2008, and he's running against a guy named Dan Sullivan, who is a former state attorney general and a former natural resources commissioner in Alaska. He was the Republican establishment's choice in the primary, and he narrowly beat out a guy named, well, not narrowly, but he beat it by like 10, 12 points, a guy named Joe Miller, who is a Tea Party Republican, who made waves in 2010 when he actually beat a sitting senator for the Republican nomination named Lisa Murkowski. And Lisa Murkowski ended up having to win as a writing candidate in 2010 in what was probably the craziest race of the entire cycle. But she ended up winning, and she's still in the Senate today as a Republican, but she didn't actually get her party's nomination, but still managed to keep her seat. But anyway, the race in Alaska in 2014 is very close. The polls have it very tight. Dan Sullivan, the Republican, has a small lead in the polling averages. I'd say the main thing to keep in mind with Alaska is that the polling there is kind of tough. A, it's a very small population, only a little over 600,000 people, if I recall correctly. And a lot of those populations are far flung. I guess the population center is Anchorage, but then there are many, particularly indigenous people who live in the islands and the Aleutians, up in the inside the Arctic Circle. And so it's difficult to really get a good poll there consistently. And so the polling is just always very uncertain. In fact, in 2008, it looked like Mark Begich was going to win comfortably over then-Senator Ted Stevens, who had actually just been convicted of on corruption charges. Later, those corruption charges were actually dropped after he appealed, and I won't go into it. But the point is, Begich looked like he was going to win comfortably, or if not comfortably, he was going to win by 2, 3, 4 points. He ended up winning by just over a point, and no one actually knew the outcome until a few weeks later because of absentee ballots and re-canvassing the actual ballots that had been cast to make sure they had the right counts. So it took a while to actually certify the winner in that race. And I will say that that actually is something that could happen again this year. Something just to keep in mind generally is that we may not know on election night who controls the Senate. And one of the reasons is because we may not know who won Alaska for a very long time. More than a day, not only because it's a few hours behind us time zone wise, but anyway, Alaska is very close. Moving east to Colorado, another toss-up race. This one actually has a Democratic incumbent also running for re-election named Mark Udall, and his opponent is a Republican in the U.S. House named Cory Gardner. And that race has only recently been moved to toss-up by us, and that's because Gardner is now either even or slightly ahead of Udall in the polling averages. And so that actually represents a very impressive takeover opportunity for Republicans, because if they're only winning in states that Mitt Romney won, what does that really tell us? Oh, well, the state's a Republican-leaning state, and a Republican won there. Kind of shrug your shoulders. That should be expected to some extent. But if a Republican can win in a state that Barack Obama won twice, that at least says something about expanding their appeal, or a change of some kind has occurred. And so in Colorado, a state that Barack Obama won twice, Republicans have a shot at winning. I will say that the only reason Democrats should feel good at all about that situation is that in 2010, there was a Senate race there where the Republican led or was tied or led 17 of the last 18 polls after Labor Day and ended up losing. And that is because, for some reason, Colorado has been all polling in Colorado has underestimated Democratic performance over the last few cycles consistently. And so if Cory Gardner is up by like a half point in the polling averages, if things kind of remain as they have been, that would suggest to us that maybe Mark Udall will end up actually winning. And another new aspect is that Colorado is the third state to have all mail balloting. And I don't mean M-A-L-E, I mean M-A-I-L, all post balloting. No, it's not 1919. But there will be the third state after Oregon and Washington now to use this in all their elections. So every voter gets a ballot mailed to them, and they have to mail it back. So I guess it's like everybody having an absentee ballot. So that has the potential to perhaps help Democrats with some of their turnout issues in a midterm election environment. But we'll have to see. We're obviously keeping a close eye on it. Moving east to Kansas, which is the strangest race in this entire cycle. Kansas, you may not know, but is a rock-ribbed Republican state. It hasn't elected someone who wasn't a Republican to the Senate since 1932. and yet it's a toss-up. And there are a few reasons for this. The incumbent senator there, and actually I should say this is, as we've been putting it, a real fly in the ointment for Republicans as they're trying to figure out how do they get to a majority. The incumbent there is a guy named Pat Roberts. He's been in the Senate since 96. He's been in the House, he's been in Congress since the early 80s from Kansas. And he doesn't seem to be running very good campaigns at all, in the sense that his primary campaign, he barely beat a guy who was a doctor, or who is a doctor, who posted pictures on Facebook of deceased patients and made macabre comments about them on Facebook. Yeah, I would say he was like a C-level, D-level challenger, and yet he almost beat Roberts in the primary. Roberts' main problem is that there were things like pictures taken of him in his really nice car with a Virginia license plate. And that increasingly is something that voters, especially in a primary election, are just not going to allow or are not going to be okay with. This happened in 2012, actually, in Indiana with Richard Lugar, who was a longtime senator from there. And he actually lost in his primary, and Democrats ended up going on to pick up that seat because Republicans nominated a guy who was just too conservative in Lugar's place. So Roberts survived, though, survived all this. If anyone decent had challenged him, he probably would have lost, given that he almost lost to that guy. And so in the general election, it looked like, well, Roberts will win because it's Kansas. Well, the story, there were more plot turns, as it turned out. The Democrat dropped out of the race. And there was there's a very wealthy independent running who was doing very well in the polls. And so the Democrat dropped out of the race. In fact, Republicans were so worried about this that their Secretary of State in Kansas, who was a Republican, sued to basically force Democrats to keep that guy on the ballot. Because this guy named Greg Orman, who's the independent, is actually pulling ahead of Roberts. In fact, he's consistently pulling ahead of him. And that race very shortly may be leaning independent. And Orman is interesting because we have no idea who he'll caucus with if he wins. Republicans are claiming that he will absolutely caucus with the Democrats, that he's a crypto Democrat. And maybe he will end up caucusing with them, given the really harsh attack ads that are being run against him. So maybe he'll be like, I don't want to caucus with people who've been attacking me for a few months. But at the end of the day, if he wants to run re-election in Kansas, he should probably be an independent Republican. So very, very strange race. Probably some more twists in that race before the end. But it's probably the craziest race this cycle. Moving south to the other toss-up on our board, Louisiana. Louisiana is a strange state for many reasons, but among them, it has a very unique election system. And it's called a jungle primary. And whereas in most states you have a primary election and all the parties choose their nominees in those primary elections or at a convention or something of that matter, well, you know, a few months before the general election. In Louisiana, they throw everybody on the ballot at the same time in November. So you might have 5 Republicans, 4 Democrats, a couple Libertarians, maybe a Green Party person, who knows. And actually, there are 9 candidates, if I recall correctly, on the ballot this year. And so Senator Mary Landrieu, who's the Democrat from there, she's running for her 4th term. To win, someone has to get a majority on Election Day. And if they don't, the top 2 finishers advance to a runoff in December. Landrieu is probably not going to get to 50%. She'll probably finish first in November, but she's not going to get to 50%. And so in all likelihood, there's going to be a runoff in December between her and a guy named Bill Cassidy, who's a House member from Louisiana, Republican. And the two of them will be in a runoff election on December 6th of this year. And the interesting thing about that is, and unfortunately, it's probably not going to play out this way from the sense that we would like to have fun with elections, right? Well, December 6th is also the same day as the Southeastern Conference Football Championship. And if LSU were to somehow make it to the SEC Championship game, Louisiana reporters have told me they dreaded that possible outcome because there are enough stories about how corrupt and terrible Louisiana is. The last thing they need is an election that gets swayed by having a football game the same day. But at the moment, I think that's probably not going to happen. LSU doesn't look very good. So they avoided that outcome. But they're probably going to go to a runoff on December 6th. Kind of moving from there, The other races worth talking about are some of the ones, or at least two of the ones you see there in stripes there, Iowa and Arkansas. Those are states that we think are leaning Republican, and they're both currently held by Democrats. I'll start with Arkansas because it's just north of Louisiana. It seems like a natural next point. Mark Pryor is the incumbent there, Democrat, as I said. He's kind of a political scion. His father was a governor and senator. The Pryor name is very strong in Arkansas, but the D label after his name is not very strong in Arkansas anymore. This is not Bill Clinton's Arkansas. Barack Obama won 37% of the vote there in 2012. So the Democratic label has really just fallen apart in Arkansas. And Pryor is now the only Democratic member of the congressional legislation from there, where it used to be almost all Democrats just 4 years ago. So his challenger is a guy named Tom Cotton, who is a Republican member of the House. And Cotton is polling ahead of him. Polling averages 3-4 points ahead of Pryor. In fact, we think Pryor has actually done better than we expected. We thought maybe we might write this race off pretty quickly. But Pryor hung around. We actually moved it back to toss-up for a while because they were polling very, very evenly. But Cotton has opened up a lead here. And we tend to think that at this point Cotton is going to be strong enough to win. That's basically the sum of the Arkansas race. Moving north to Iowa, the other race that is leaning Republican that Democrats currently hold, Senator Tom Harkin is retiring. And he's been there since 1984, if I'm recalling correctly. And he's a Democrat, and he's stepping aside. And so with an open seat contest, Democrats nominated a guy named Bruce Braley, who has run one of the worst campaigns of the cycle. He's a member of the U.S. House. And I only say that because it was Politico, the political magazine brought up or did this list of the 5 worst campaigns of the cycle. Roberts was one in Kansas, but Bruce Braley also got mentioned. It's not a very good campaign strategy to insult farmers in Iowa as a general rule. Just, I don't think that, it feels like that might be a large segment of the population, might not go over very well. So Braley got caught on camera talking to some lawyers in Texas at a fundraiser. He's a trial lawyer, and he was talking to a group of trial lawyers trying to raise money. And he said something like, you need to make sure that I win and the Democrats keep the majority, because if we don't, an Iowa farmer with no law degree is going to become chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that would be Chuck Grassley, the other senator from Iowa, who's very, very popular in Iowa. And so at the end of the day, it was really easy for Republicans to be like, that guy is attacking Iowa farmers. I mean, you just talk about handing your opponents a gift-wrapped campaign attack. And so his opponent is a woman named Joni Ernst. She's a state senator, very personable, real strong, like personality politics. She's crushing Braley because she's just really good in person, apparently. And her main claim to fame is how she won the Republican nomination, because she was getting outspent vastly by this businessman named Mark Jacobs in the Republican primary. So Joni Ernst cuts one ad, and she only really, well, she might have cut more than that, but she only really needed this one ad because, and I shouldn't have used the word cut because that kind of spoils the surprise. It was about how she'd grown up as a kid on a farm castrating pigs, so she knew how to cut pork. That really won over Iowa Republicans, and she won the nomination very easily. The tagline at the end is like, send me to Washington and I'll make him squeal. So anyway, Joni Ernst, we think, is a slight favorite there at the moment. It's going to be very close, though. That, I think, is a given. Iowa, like Colorado, is another state that Barack Obama won twice, and so that would be a real big win for Republicans in terms of talking about, is this really a wave? Did something really happen here, or is it just Republicans winning where they should win? So kind of moving east from there, at this point, there are only probably 3 other races really worth mentioning, and one of them is North Carolina, which is the one area where Democrats can kind of smile about this map is that North Carolina is a state where they were really worried about their incumbent there. Her name's Kay Hagan. She was first elected in 2008. And the expectation kind of at the beginning of the cycle was this woman was going to be in a lot of trouble. North Carolina is fundamentally a more Democratic state than any of the others I've been talking about, really, except for Iowa and Colorado. Barack Obama actually won it in 2008, and Mitt Romney won it by just 2 points in 2012. So it's a lot closer politically than some of these other states at the presidential level. But Hagan is ahead in the polls over her opponent. He's got a guy named Tom Tillis, who's the state House speaker. And that's probably largely because Tillis can be very easily, well, he's speaker of the state House, so he can be very easily connected to the extremely unpopular state legislature in North Carolina. And Hagan has also vastly outraised him. And at the end of the day, we actually moved this race to leans Democratic a couple weeks ago, just kind of indicating our feeling that Hagan actually has a shot at winning re-election here and that she's a favorite. We'll see if anything shakes out in the last 27 days or so. But at this point, that would actually be a bright spot for Democrats on this map. And probably the other two races are Georgia and Kentucky. And those get a lot of attention, particularly Kentucky, because obviously the minority leader of the Senate, Republican Mitch McConnell, is there. And Democrats have been really, really buoyed by the idea of beating the Senate minority leader in the year where he might be in a position to take the majority leadership position. But we've had that race at likely Republican since the get-go, and we aren't moving it yet. There was a poll that came out on Monday that showed Allison Lundergan Grimes, who's McConnell's opponent, ahead by 2 points. But until we see some further confirmation of that, we're going to treat that as an outlier, because all the other polls have shown McConnell up, not by a lot. McConnell has actually very rarely had a race where he blew out his opponent. He barely won the first time when he defeated a guy named Dee Huddleston in 1984. And since then, and that was like a race decided by like 0.2 percentage point. Since then, he's only had one race where he beat anybody by more than 8 points. So he's used to being in close fought races and has a gigantic war chest. And oh, by the way, Kentucky is a state where Barack Obama is terribly, terribly, terribly unpopular, and a state where Republicans have been sweeping it up at the federal level for a while now. So there's really the fundamentals, I think, are going to hold Grimes back from having any shot. If this were 2006, maybe she'd have a chance. But I think given that it's 2014, it's an environment that is advantageous to Republicans, McConnell should hold on. And the other race is Georgia, where I will just say that Michelle Nunn, the Democrat, has made a good fight of it. Her opponent's a guy named David Perdue, who's a cousin of the former governor there, Sonny Perdue. And David Perdue is ahead in the polls, but in order to get elected in Georgia, you have to get a majority of the vote. And if no one gets a majority of the vote in November, they have a runoff. But the runoff, curiously, is on January 6th, 2015, which is 3 days after Congress is supposed to convene. There are some fun overtime scenarios about how we won't know who controls the Senate because of a possible runoff in Georgia, the very likely runoff in Louisiana, the fact that an independent might win Kansas, and we may not know who he's going to caucus with for a very long time. So there's some fun, and obviously also I mentioned Alaska. We may not know for a while there either. So, again, we may not know for a while who really controls the Senate. So I think that about covers it on the Senate. And I will just say that I can talk about governors if people have questions, but there's a lot to go into. And I'll just say that very generally speaking, I should actually mention before I leave the Senate slide. At the moment, we're projecting Republicans to win 5 to 8 seats. 5 would be insufficient for a majority. A 50-50 tie is good for Democrats. Vice President Joe Biden could break the tie in their favor, so they would maintain control. But otherwise, the rest of that that outlook would give Republicans a majority. Now, again, there are complications that might be thrown in there because of like the race in Kansas, but we'll just have to see how that plays out. And at the moment, I'll just say about the governor's races because I want to take questions. At the moment, it looks like Democrats are in a position. The only real surefire takeover that's going to occur is going to be in Pennsylvania. Governor Tom Corbett is a dead man walking, politically speaking. First-term Republican, and he's very likely to lose to a guy named Tom Wolf, who's the Democratic nominee. And if this does play out as we expect it to, it'll be the first time since, I think, the early 40s that Pennsylvania won't have practiced this this systematic switching of the governorship every 8 years between the parties. It's like every 8 years they switched hands, up until now, from the looks of things. And Republicans have a good shot. We're probably, again, because of Arkansas, I was talking about it earlier, it's become a very Republican state. Republicans are probably in a position to take back Arkansas as well. That's why we have it in that striped coloring there as a takeover. Illinois is also an opportunity for Republicans, but the incumbent there, Pat Quinn, who's a Democrat, is actually looking stronger than we initially thought. And so we may be moving that back to toss-up shortly. But again, I can take questions about that. But I think the real drama in this election is a focus on the Senate. And so that's why I spent most of the time talking about it. But I'll just end this part of it by just saying, if you want more of this, we have a newsletter that we put out every Thursday morning. It's called The Crystal Ball. And you can either go to our website and sign up for it, which is right there, or you can email us your email address, and we will add you to our list. And the best part is the price is right, because it's free. And so, yeah, at this point, I'll take questions about whatever, really. Oh, political.
About Montana and South Dakota in the Senate race.
Yes. Oh, that's not what we wanted. Does that work? I meant to hit back, and apparently I didn't hit the back button. I'll just say Montana at this point is basically a foregone conclusion Republicans will win there. What happened was Max Baucus, who was the incumbent there, the incumbent Democrat, decided he wasn't going to run for re-election, and then he resigned and took the ambassadorship to China. And so the Democratic governor in Montana, Steve Bullock, appointed John Walsh, who was his lieutenant governor and the Democratic nominee for that Senate seat, trying to boost Walsh's appeal. And then it turned out, well, by doing that, that kind of turned the media's focus more on Walsh than maybe it would have been otherwise. And the New York Times discovered that, he had plagiarized part of his master's thesis at the U.S. Army War College. And in the end, that basically killed Walsh. And Walsh ended up dropping out of the race. So he's just going to be a senator for a few months and then be gone in January. And so Democrats had to make an emergency nomination. And so at the end of the day, it looks like that Representative Steve Daines, who's the first-term Republican from there, and the House, their lone House member in Montana, will be the next senator. But in South Dakota, that is a race that actually I probably should have mentioned during the talk, because it's gotten suddenly kind of interesting, almost rivaling Kansas as the most interesting race in this cycle, because it looked at the beginning like Mike Rounds, who was a former governor there and the Republican nominee, was going to have a very easy time winning. But he's got this scandal over EB-5 visas some hijinks that occurred during his administration as governor that is coming back to haunt him. An EB-5 visa is a visa that you can get if you give $500,000, or if you invest $500,000 or more. I learned this today, by the way. $500,000 or more in a rural or an area with high unemployment if you're a foreigner. So you can basically buy a visa. At least I think that's how opponents of the program would probably construe it. Not that I am one. I don't have an opinion on that. It's just not – I didn't want to come across like I did. So anyway, there's been a whole lot of hubbub with that that has really kind of dragged Rounds down. And the other factor is that there is an independent in the race named Larry Pressler. And Larry Pressler was actually formerly held this seat, and he held it until he lost it in 1996 to Tim Johnson, who is the current incumbent who is retiring in South Dakota, a Democrat. Larry Pressler is a former Republican, but now he's running as an independent, and he's been catching up in the polls. In fact, he's almost even with the Democrat, a guy named Rick Wyland, who used to work for Tom Daschle, former senator from South Dakota. And at this point, Wyland and Pressler, running second and third, are combining for about half the vote. And Rounds is a little under 40%, at least in the polls. So theoretically, if one of Wyland or Pressler were to drop out of the race, it might create the circumstances where one of them, whoever didn't drop out, could potentially beat Rounds. Not sure if that'll happen or not. In fact, I expect that probably won't happen because it doesn't look like either. Kind of like in Kansas where the guy did drop out, doesn't look like that's going to probably happen in South Dakota. But it has put the likely Republican rating we have in some doubt, and we are monitoring it. In fact, it's a big part of our write-up for tomorrow's newsletter is about South Dakota and some of what's going on there. So it's no sure thing at this point for Republicans. Yes, sir.
Very good talk, by the way.
Thanks.
So if it is a like 50-50 and Orman wins in Kansas, would his decision as to who he caucuses with decide who's the majority? I mean, how would a majority leader be selected at that point?
Well, I think one of the probably the most likely outcome if Orman does win, it's in a position to do that, would be if there are 50 Republicans, 49 Democrats, and Orman. And if Orman chooses to caucus with the Democrats, he could probably hold out, at least theoretically, for something like Harry Reid can no longer be majority leader. I'm not voting with the Democrats. And he said that that's an idea that he's had. So he could actually perhaps hold either side hostage over this because he might say at the same time, well, I won't caucus with the Republicans unless Mitch McConnell is no longer majority leader. So he could theoretically hold a lot of power there. But again, as I said earlier, if he's going to be self-serving, he should probably go ahead and caucus with the Republicans because it's Kansas, and if he wants to win in 6 years, that would probably be a good strategy to be an independent Republican. But if he doesn't care about that, and he's also peeved because these guys have been running ads against him, calling him many things, and he ends up caucusing with the Democrats, it really leaves a lot of uncertainty out there. This is why Republicans need to make sure they win some of these other races so they don't have to worry about the Greg Orman factor. But especially with the stuff going on in South Dakota, there's just a lot more question marks being thrown in at this late date than I feel like you normally see. It's usually the picture clarifies as we move on. Well, actually, it's getting kind of muddier in this case. So Orman could hold a lot of power. And if someone like Pressler wins in South Dakota somehow, and you've got two independents, neither of whom are saying who they're going to caucus with, because Pressler actually endorsed Barack Obama in 2008, even though he's a former Republican member of the Senate. That could create some kind of independent caucus, because there are already two independents in the Senate. One is Bernie Sanders, who will always caucus with the Democrats because he's an avowed independent socialist. So he's not going to there's no way he would ever caucus with the Republicans. So we can pretty much bank on him always caucusing with the Democrats. He actually won the Democratic nomination, but chose to not use it the first time he ran. The other guy is Angus King, who's a senator from Maine, who's an independent, currently caucuses with the Democrats. But if King wanted to, and he's probably would enjoy this, he could join in with Orman and Pressler and form some kind of independent caucus that could actually swing control of the Senate based on whatever the issue of the moment is. I mean, who knows? It's kind of wild, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens. But that's kind of the situation.
You talked about the House of Representatives, but I'm curious about your thoughts on the 3rd District here in Virginia and the judicial ruling yesterday, which throws it into question in 2015.
To clarify, so yesterday there was a ruling that came down that said that the 3rd District in Virginia, which is a majority-minority district, it's got about 56% African-American population, was ruled unconstitutional, mainly because of the recent undoing of parts of the Voting Rights Act, which basically the judge said that because certain parts of the Voting Rights Act had been ruled unconstitutional, that there was no longer a constitutionally justifiable reason to keep the have a majority-minority district be required in this circumstance. So there's a lot that could happen there. I think at this point it's mostly speculation. But I will say this. I mean, the third district runs from Richmond to Hampton Roads, and it's very crudely drawn in order to have an African-American majority in the district. So what could happen is if that's no longer a requirement, you could have a district that is much more centered out of Richmond, and the second district might become much more Democratic because it would probably take in more parts of Norfolk than it does currently, and a Republican holds that seat. I would say the probably the overall view is that this was a favorable outcome for Democrats because the General Assembly is going to have to draw new lines in 2015, but now Democrats control the governorship, and so that gives them some veto power, and if all else fails, it ends up being court-drawn, which is almost certain to still be a better map for Democrats than the current map. So I think that's kind of the overall view, but I enjoy speculating and drawing what the map could look like, but I don't really have any idea what they'll end up coming up with. Yes, ma'am.
Well, on the more or less local races, does Ed Gillespie have a chance?
Yeah, I should probably mention the Virginia race when I talked to
him. And then another question I have is about Bratt and Trammell.
Yes. The Virginia race at this point, we have it rated likely Democratic. I mean, the polling has Warner fairly comfortably ahead in the polling averages. And so I think at this point, Gillespie is going to have a tough time winning. It's not going to be a blowout or anything. I mean, again, Virginia is a very, very close run state, politically speaking. It was the state that was closest to the national outcome in both the last two presidential elections. And at this point, it's hard, unless there's a huge wave environment, like say in 2009, which was kind of a precursor to 2010, when we saw Bob McDonnell, who's famous for other reasons now, but he won, in a landslide in 2009. But unless there's that kind of environment where one side has, a full tailwind, it's going to be very hard for either side to really crush the other side in Virginia in a statewide election. And so Warner is going to win probably, but it won't be a blowout or anything. So, Gillespie might have further ambitions. He might try to run for governor in 2017. That was actually discussed as an entire reason for him to get into the race, was to up his name ID. I mean, it worked for Mark Warner. He lost the Senate race in 1996 and ended up being elected governor in 2001. So maybe Gillespie's taking a similar path. We'll just have to see. But at this point, it's tough to see how Gillespie can win, given where the polls are at and the fact that there's less than a month to go. The Virginia 7th race, yeah, that was a real interesting outcome. I was actually at a concert that night here in Charlottesville. This is to say that I had absolutely no idea that Dave Bratt was going to beat Eric Cantor in the Republican primary in the 7th district, and no one else did. Anyone who does, including the Bratt campaign, is full of it. It was a crazy race. I would say that at this point, I mean, it's a safe Republican district. It's a district that Mitt Romney won 57% of the vote in. And so it's very hard to imagine a Democrat being able to win that race. So Trammell probably is not going to be able to win. He might keep it closer than he would otherwise, but I think it's pretty much Bratt's a sure thing to win. I mean, we have it rated safe Republican. So, yeah.
It's hard to go back and forth between the governors and the Senate, but you probably know it. Alaska, for example, is undecided both at the Senate and the governor, and it looks like Kansas or Colorado. Can you make any comment there?
I keep doing this. I don't know why I keep doing this. I'm pretty good with technology, but apparently not tonight. I just keep looking down and hitting the first thing I see instead of just click off on that. Yes, the thing that is taped with red on here is what I should be clicking. It's like, that's the whole reason it probably is like that. Yes, so, the way I would look at it is like this. There are 36 governorships up this cycle. 28 of them have incumbents running them. In fact, 29, but in Hawaii, the incumbent, Neil Abercrombie, actually lost in his primary. So there are 28 who've made it to the general election. So that's a lot of incumbents. In fact, that's the most incumbents in a very long time to be running. And I think if there is a theme to this election besides kind of an issue to this election besides, the president, is that voters are just really unhappy with how things are right now, kind of regardless of party. So a governor's race where kind of managerial ability and kind of day-to-day things like dealing with education and transportation funding and some things that are not quite as – are not so big in the kind of the federal election discussion are getting brought up in a lot of these races. And so in Kansas, for example, again, rock-ribbed Republican state. Sam Brownback, who's a former senator, he left his Senate seat, in fact, to become governor, and won very easily in 2010, is in a position where he may very well lose in 2014 despite Kansas's lean. And that speaks a lot to the fact that they are having serious budgetary problems in Kansas, in part because of a tax cut he passed. At least that's where the blame is going. And so I'm not going to bring that up. There was a story about something that the Kansas government was selling that wasn't – never mind. The point is it's kind of X-rated, if you get my drift. They were selling things that they had captured from certain establishments in order to deal with the fact that they didn't have any money. So in Kansas, Brownback is in trouble despite the state's Republican lean. And Alaska, you've got a fusion ticket. So the Democrat dropped down to the lieutenant governor spot on the ballot to join in with a guy named Byron Mallett, the independent. Or actually, is that the Democrat? That's the Democrat. The Democrat's Bill Walker. Byron Mallett. The independent's a guy named Bill Walker. And he's now the gubernatorial candidate. And so they formed this fusion ticket to run against Sean Parnell, who is the governor who took over after Sarah Palin abandoned her responsibilities as governor. I'm not a fan of Sarah Palin. That's my one statement. You say you want to be like a leader, and then you resign the Alaska governorship to go be like a reality TV star. Well, okay. And you want to run for president again. Oh, really? And that's what you do. Okay. Point being, Parnell looked to be in really good shape, and then Democrats in this independent formed this fusion ticket, and now that race is a toss-up. And I think this just speaks to the fact that at the end of the day, on the governor vote in particular, voters do look a little bit past partisan ID, especially in an environment that is not I've said that this is a favorable environment for Republicans. It is not not close to what 2010 was. So it's not like some no-name Republican is going to win in a seat where no Republican ever thought they had a chance, which is the kind of thing that could happen in an environment like 2010. In 2014, things are a little bit more even. And so I think people are looking at, in Alaska's case, particularly the tax on oil companies up there that was lowered by Parnell, and that kind of caused a backlash. Because as you can imagine, Alaska gets a lot of their general fund money from taxes on oil. And so I think those issues end up getting a little bit more weight and attention in an atmosphere where it's not so one-sided for one side or the other. And Colorado also has some particulars. John Hickenlooper, who's the incumbent governor there, he's in trouble because of a gun control law that they passed that ended up getting a couple state senators recalled who were Democrats. They did a recall election, and two of them lost to Republicans. There's also been this guy who was convicted of murder, and then there's a whole lot of hubbub with this because he's been appealing, and Hickenlooper has talked about pardoning the guy, and this has created a backlash. So Hickenlooper has some local trouble on the ground there that is giving him issues. And so his opponent, a guy named Bill Beaupre, who is a former member of the U.S. House, has a shot at winning there as well. So I think just generally, the general broad speaking point is that voters will, especially in the governor's races, will look past partisan ID to some degree, especially if there's a great amount of dissatisfaction with the status quo, which apparently there very much is from polling. Yes, sir. Or yes, ma'am. Sorry.
Generally, over time, how reliable are polls? Because our phone rings all the time, and we never answer it unless we know who's calling.
Yes. You are an example of why polling has become a very, very difficult enterprise. Because there are people like me. I don't have a landline. I would never have a landline at this point. And then plenty of people have caller ID. You're not going to answer that, and I don't know what that number is. This makes it very difficult for a couple of reasons. One, if you're using the cheapest way to poll is use automated polling. It's called IVR, but anyway, yeah. And so just, you know, some automated voice saying, whoa, or something read out to you, like press one for this, press two for that. But you can't, it's illegal to use automated polling in calling cell phones. And so if like a third or more of the population at this point is using a cell phone as their main phone, that kind of leaves out a very large sample, especially since it's disproportionately younger and much more likely to be non-white, comparatively speaking. So on the flip side, if people aren't picking up, that makes it really difficult to poll, because in order to call cell phones, that means you need to use live callers, and that makes it much more expensive for polling outfits to do that, because they actually have to hire people who are going to sit at their computer, you know, and call, well, in a, you know, I guess, you know, they all get together at whatever the polling headquarters place is, and they've got tons of computers in front of them, and they sit there and they call people, and they call people by randomized digit in the state or district or wherever they're trying to poll, and they have to pay these people to be there, and so that makes it much more expensive to actually poll. So at this point, it is possible to get a good sample. It just usually requires live calling, and that makes it more expensive, and so that actually makes it harder to poll. Because you'll see a lot of junk polls, especially from like kind of automated. Now, not all automated pollsters are junk pollsters, but a lot of them are. So a lot of groups have been experimenting, actually, with trying to overcome this by using internet panels, which is still kind of an uncertain methodology at this point. So I would say on the whole, the reason why it's never good to look at one poll is because there could be something wrong with that one poll. But if you've got 10, 15 polls, odds are that the cumulative, the aggregate, let's use a more proper terminology, the aggregate of those polls probably tells you something about what's going on in the race. And so my rule of thumb is if somebody's winning by more than 3 points in the polling average, they're probably in a position to win. Because the only times that the polling averages have misfired since 2004 were on races where in at least one polling average, there was somebody inside of 3 points. And those are the only misses. Otherwise, it's been right every time. So I'm sure at some point that will be proven wrong in some particular episode. Maybe it'll be 4 points in some race. But at the moment, that's why it's good to look at the polling averages, and that's why we always talk about the polling averages. Because one poll, two polls, insufficient. That's why that poll in Kentucky I was talking about that showed Allison Lundgren and Grimes up two. Oh, that doesn't tell me very much. What are the other polls saying? Oh, McConnell's up by 5, 4, 6, 8, you know, 7. Okay, well, McConnell's probably still leading. And so that's kind of how a way of overcoming it. But pollsters have huge challenges, and they're trying to deal with them right now, and there's a huge adjustment going on, and it's written about all the time now. So, yeah, it's obviously very interesting.
Can you tell me what's happening in Michigan with Snyder? Is it because of bankruptcy in Detroit, or is there something else going on with him?
Snyder, actually, that race has moved back in Snyder's direction. We have a toss-up up there right now, but we are likely going to move that to leans Republican again. We had it at leans Republican. Snyder, I don't think the bankruptcy has had all that much. I mean, maybe it has locally there, but I think at the end of the day, Snyder is helped out by the fact he's an incumbent, and he's not a terribly unpopular incumbent, so I think that's helped him out. And so at the end of August and the beginning of September, his opponent, Mark Schauer, who's a former member of the U.S. House, had actually basically caught up to Snyder. They were running almost even in the polling averages. But since then, Snyder his lead has come back, and it's actually at like 3.5 right now. At least I was looking at this earlier. So I think on the whole, incumbency plays a large role. Kind of getting back to that question earlier about like why are all these states toss-ups, even though they might lean real hard one way or the other? Well, incumbency is a very important thing. Like talking about the Alaska Senate race, incumbency. That's the only reason Democrats have a shot at holding on to that seat is because they have a Democratic incumbent there. And same with Arkansas. And that's illustrated by the fact that like in Montana, the longtime incumbent Baucus gets out of the race or has decided he's not going to run for re-election. That immediately made it a good target for Republicans. And the same in West Virginia, a state that is now safe Republican on the Senate side. Oh, that's the wrong way. There we go. Simply because the longtime incumbent there, Jay Rockefeller, decided to retire. And so an open seat is always more difficult to defend, especially if the state has been moving away from your party. So in Michigan, Michigan's not so overwhelmingly Democratic that Schauer had kind of a natural he has some advantages because of that, because Michigan is more Democratic than not. It hasn't gone for a Republican since 1988 in a presidential election. But it's not so overwhelmingly Democratic, say, like, I don't know, Hawaii, or as Republican a state as Arkansas has become or West Virginia has become. It was easier for Snyder to find, or it will be easier for him probably to get to 50% or those whereabouts to win. Now, granted, at the same time, Democrats are favored to hold on to the Senate seat there. And I will say that one concern for Snyder is that it looks like the Senate race in Michigan isn't going to be very close. And it's between a guy named Gary Peterson, who's a member of the House, who's a Democrat, and a woman named Terry Lynn Land, who is a former Secretary of State in Michigan. And that race was expected to be kind of close, but Peterson's moving rapidly ahead. It seems like Land's campaign is kind of falling apart. And I will say this, it's harder and harder in this day and age because of polarization for two races simultaneously going on, two statewide elections, to really go too far apart. So it'll be interesting to see just how far they do run apart, because clearly Snyder is going to run well ahead of Land. So it's just a question of how much can he run ahead of Land, because I'm pretty sure ballot positioning wise, Land will come before Snyder, because I think the federal races come above the state races. So it'll be interesting. Yes, sir.
Seeing as phone polling seems to be falling apart, what's the status of social media polling, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the rest of those sites?
Well, it's interesting. I saw a paper published about using Xbox Live data before the 2012 election. And if you're not familiar with Xbox Live, the Xbox, the game console, video game console, on the internet, you have this thing called Xbox Live, which allows you to connect and play online with other people all around the world. And using that, Microsoft actually did a lot of polling before the 2012 election. And this paper was written basically to argue that it was that despite the fact that it was an overwhelmingly male and younger sample, that they were able to actually get a pretty good poll out of it. And I think that comes to the idea that there's debate about this, about whether or not you can use a bad sample and still get a good poll. And that has to do with, that sounds funny, but it has to do with weighing, and you weight certain segments. But the trouble I think you get in there is if you have a very small segment of people who form a much larger one in the overall population, I think that exposes you to problems when you start weighting for a very small number of people who are in your sample, and they're supposed to represent a much larger group. So I would say at this point, they're still working on that. I know there's been some stuff using Twitter. But again, I think at this point, getting an accurate result out of that is tough to say. And there's a lot of debate about whether they will ever be able to or not. But there are definitely people trying, that much I can tell you, because it seems like a really obvious way to use something that a lot of people use every day, especially Facebook. I mean, tons of people use Facebook to get some kind of idea of what's going on. And campaigns have obviously been using this as it's like, oh, you clicked like on this thing that had nothing to do with politics, but it tells me something about you. And so I can probably figure out who you're going to vote for. It's kind of scary, right? But
it tells you want to shop at L.L. Bean.
Ah.
I've heard some talking heads on TV talking about the Republican Party becoming a grumpy old white men. What is your thought on the direction that you see the Republican Party headed?
Well, demographically, that's not the most inaccurate thing that's ever been said on television. If you look at the 2012 presidential result, and actually, I'll just go ahead and the gender thing is just set in the sense that Democrats are consistently winning women and Republicans are consistently winning men. There's been a gender gap in every presidential election going back to was it 1980, I believe, was the first one where there was a real noticeable gender gap, and it's been that way ever since. And almost every Senate race shows it. We did a thing a little while back looking at exit polling in Senate races. So the gender gap is just kind of a fact of life at this point. And so when you're talking about, and what I was going to say before I went off on that little part of that, was that if you look at the by age vote, there was an obvious correlation between support for the Republican as age went up. Every cohort was larger. Republicans did the worst with 18 to 29-year-olds, did a little bit better between 30 to 44-year-olds, did even better among 45 to 64-year-olds, and among 65-year-olds, they did the best. And I think at this point, that's not necessarily going away, but I do think what's a little disconcerting is that we may be heading into a situation where Democrats continue to be really strong among non-white voters, but Republicans end up winning more white voters, and then you end up with a system where maybe both the parties are aligned along race, which is not something we want to see, because it's basically like living in Mississippi. Not that I don't like Mississippi, but that is essentially what you have there. In Mississippi, exit polls show that Democrats, among African Americans, 95% of the vote for Obama. Among whites there, 90% of the vote for Romney. I mean, that's just about as strident a difference as you can see. And so I think that it's very possible, though, that for Republicans moving forward to 2016, that may be what they end up trying to do. And it's really particularly – in fact, this is why it's good to have the Electoral College map. the place where they can make gains in 2016 is in the Midwest, because – and those are states where there's still a pretty strong number of white voters who are voting Democratic. And so if they want to peel off some more white voters, that would be a very natural place to go. Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota to some degree. But particularly Wisconsin and Ohio would be very obvious targets for that. And so we've talked about that, meaning maybe in 2016 they want to nominate a Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. Or nominate Rick Schneider, the governor of Michigan, or John Kasich, probably more likely than of all the three from Ohio. So I think overall I would say that I don't think there's much change on that front coming. But I will say that the thing about politics is that things are always moving to some degree. And so a lot of people have said, oh, like Republicans have to help pass comprehensive immigration reform to win back Latino voters. Maybe, but they might be able to still cut into them a little bit in the sense that they may still lose Latino voters, but they may win 40% of them and not 25% of them. And that is a sizable number of people. And so it's just kind of, you know, what do they have to do? It's also very hard for the same party to win three straight presidential elections. And that's what Democrats are faced with. Even if they nominate Hillary Clinton, that's no sure thing. It's not like we can go ahead and write off 2016 for Democrats because Hillary's the nominee. I mean, the previous president's approval is important, and I can't imagine Obama's approval rating getting much better than it is now. It may not get much worse, but at the same time, it's not going to be great either. So this is kind of a rambling answer, and I was covering lots. There are a bunch of different facets to this, I think, is probably the best way to look at it. But I don't think the demographics of the parties are going to change anytime soon, but I do think that there's been a lot of doomsaying on the Republican side and a lot of rah-rahing on the Democratic side about demographic changes helping Democrats. But none of that is written in stone, would be, I think, my final point on that.
I'm wondering if you're seeing any of the distress and, for lack of a better word, disenchantment with the voting public today, just based on the inactivity created in the Congress by the Republican Party. And I realize this sounds partisan, and I'm trying to be as objective as I can be, but I'm wondering if, in fact, that will affect the outcomes of any of the coming elections. Rather than just the polling statistically, you know, is there an emotional factor here that people may not be expressing and will express at the polls?
I think at this point, it's very obvious that the country is largely dissatisfied with the status quo, politically, economically, kind of the whole gamut. But I do think that, I'm trying to think of the best to answer this. I would say on the whole, though, that the polling data we have for the races that are going on is pretty helpful. And I don't think that there's going to be some, I think particularly because of dysfunction in Washington, that speaks to why people are angry. But I don't think that's actually going to alter how they vote all that much. Because both sides think that their side is right, without question. And in a midterm election, the electorate is much smaller than in a presidential election. So in the last couple of presidential elections, turnout's been 60% or more of the voting age population. In the last midterm, it was about 40. And it's probably about 40 this time as well. And I think at the end of the day, in a midterm election, you're going to get more of the hard partisans on each side showing up to vote because they're the ones who are most animated to always make sure to vote. And you're going to have less of the, not necessarily swing voters, but voters who may tend to vote one way or the other, but they aren't as engaged. And they're just not going to be as many of them showing up. And they're the ones who can actually swing things to some degree. And so I think with that in mind, the fact that you're going to have people showing up who've had their minds made up for a very long time, well before any recent election, would indicate to me that you're not going to see some kind of shift just because of what's going on in D.C. affecting one side or the other overwhelmingly. I think at the end of the day, the main effect is that the White House is occupied by a Democrat, so the people who are most energized to vote are Republican partisans because of that. And in 2006, the most energized were Democratic partisans because there was a Republican in the White House. So it kind of works that way.
I have heard speculation that Senator Warner, assuming he's reelected, may only serve for a year or so and then resign. McAuliffe can appoint another Democrat to that position. He can retool himself as a centrist and look at either the governorship or maybe high office. Do you care to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. Speculation is a lot of fun. I will say that the idea of Warner running for governor in 2017 does not seem terribly far-fetched because there was rumor that he was considering running in 2013. There's something about being, you know, the executive being a party of one versus being, you know, like 91st in seniority in the U.S. Senate that I don't think probably rubs Mark Warner the right way. Actually, I think at this point his seniority is a little higher than that, but it's still not very high. You know, he's not chairing any committees. And so the attraction of running for governor, again, may enthrall him enough that he will do that. I do think there is a possibility that he would be a VP choice in 2016. If Hillary Clinton's the nominee, she's going to be looking for somebody, either a minority or someone from a swing state. Mark Warner obviously fills the swing state category very nicely. And was a popular governor in said swing state. And I guess reasonably enough popular senator that he's probably going to win re-election. So I think that might be something that he would look at. I do think that what would be particularly amusing, though, is if he wants to get picked for 2016, he may have competition from Tim Kaine, who might actually be a stronger choice because he can speak Spanish fluently. And increasingly that's important, and Kaine might be attractive for that reason. Also being a senator from a swing state. So I think that's probably about the extent of the speculation that I can do. But I would say that the idea for him running in 2017 for governor is definitely not, like, far-fetched. Yes, ma'am.
Well, while you're speculating, and speaking of swing states, Jim Webb has indicated an interest in running for president. Any chance we might have a Clinton-Webb ticket?
You know, the idea of Jim Webb running for president is an interesting one because he didn't really seem too enthused to be running for Senate in 2006 when he won. On the campaign trail, he was kind of notoriously unenergized on the stump, doesn't really like glad-handing, probably doesn't really love raising money all that much, probably doesn't like flying to a bunch of different states to campaign. All these are reasons that I'm a little dubious of him actually running. But I will say this, he's an irascible guy. And if people start doubting him too much and he feels like the party isn't speaking, particularly on foreign policy issues, at the level he thinks they need to be speaking, I wouldn't put it beyond him to run. I mean, you can run a bare bones campaign for president. Rick Santorum did that in 2012. He went around Iowa to all 99 counties in a red pickup truck, and he ended up actually winning it. Was that a follow up or? Yeah. Sorry, I was gonna get to that. Now, if he does run, I won't say it's impossible, given that he was a senator from a swing state. Kind of speaks to Mark Warner and Tim Kaine in a similar vibe. He also military veteran, former Reagan administration Secretary of the Navy. He's got quite a CV, so he might be an attractive choice in that sense. Except, I will say that I don't think he quite fits the party now. On social issues, he's not a conservative on social issues, but he's not a rah-rah gung-ho liberal on social issues. And I think in today's Democratic Party, you probably are not going to see somebody on the ticket who is not just 100% behind kind of progressive social thought. That's why someone like Deval Patrick, who is the current governor of Massachusetts, outgoing governor, might be someone who, if Hillary Clinton runs, which it looks like she will. And wins the nomination, which she probably will, because no one's going to run against her. At least that's – well, no one of someone substantive will run against her, but no one with enough substance will be able to beat her. Martin O'Malley is going to run the current governor of Maryland, but he can't beat Hillary Clinton. I'm just going to go ahead and put that down here. He can't beat Hillary Clinton. So the party is going to be looking to nominate a woman after having nominated an African-American in 2008. The whole history-making aspect of things and the fact that it's a party that is majority female. I think there's going to be an expectation for that. So if Hillary does run, she's going to probably be the nominee. And maybe someone like Webb would be attractive given his military background. But I do think given the direction the party's gone on a lot of issues, that there are other people who might get picked ahead of him. But the idea is there. If he runs and makes a good showing, acquits himself well, that would increase the likelihood of him getting picked for sure. You see that time and time again historically in U.S. politics. I mean, think about 1980. Why does Reagan pick George H.W. Bush? Well, because George H.W. Bush finished second to him in the whole primary process. So, you know, that kind of thing can happen for sure.
We have a question from the back of the room.
This is maybe just a tiny bit tangential to your topic, but since you obviously have a command of all the numbers, can you give us any idea of where the unemployment picture would stand if we hadn't had the massive cutbacks in public services?
Honestly, I don't know, but my understanding of economics is that it would probably be lower, but I can't begin to tell you where it would actually be. I'm not an economist, but there does seem to be some truth to the whole priming the pump idea. So I guess cutting it to some degree kept the unemployment rate from falling further. But then you can have an argument about, well, what kind of employment is better employment? And I don't know. But point being, I don't know. So not really my expertise.
I want to ask a quick question.
Sure.
You guys that do these forecasts, the back room behind the crystal ball, what do you think, for example, Nick Silver, the 538 thing, everybody trumpeted how well they did on predicting 2012 election outcomes. Do you all know what the other serious groups are doing and how you're putting your forecast together and stuff? How does that play out?
Well, if they're doing it right, we should have access at least to some degree to like the model they're using or at least the components they're using. And we do, we definitely look at what people like Nate Silver are doing and other people, particularly who focus almost entirely on poll models. We always like to put it a holistic approach. So we're looking at the polls, but in a presidential election, using the polls is actually pretty effective. I mean, obviously, because Nate Silver nailed every single state. That's because there's a lot of polls. And the more polls there are, the more accurate result you're probably going to be able to get. But in a lot of races, and especially in a midterm cycle, especially talking about like House races, there's just not a lot of polling data. Or the only polling data are internal internal polls from one campaign to the other, which are essentially worthless. You don't say a Democrat's winning in that race, and it's a Democratic internal poll. I'm stunned. I can't believe it. It has a lot of value. So I think what we think is generally that it's a very useful method, and I don't like poo-pooing other people, so I'm not going to poo-poo them because I think it's very useful, and I definitely read their stuff because they're better at statistical analysis than I am, and I will very honestly say that. But I do think that for lower-level elections, you need to be able to talk to people on the ground. You need to be able to talk to the campaigns. You need to be able to communicate with reporters who are covering this stuff to get at least some kind of picture, especially in House races. That's where it's most true because there are hardly any polls from nonpartisan pollsters for House races. That almost doesn't exist unless it's extremely high profile. We talk to, and we also like to talk to like the campaign committees on each side, outside groups on each side, to see where are they investing. Because if they're investing in that place, that probably indicates that they have some level of confidence in the race that they're having. Oh, you're taking money out of that race? Oh, well, that clues me in that, well, you're probably not that supportive of that candidate now because the other guy is probably a favorite. So that's kind of the way we look at it. And we obviously love to see as much data as possible, but it's just one of those things where sometimes the data is just not available.
Thank you. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. What a... You didn't tell us exactly what to expect, but it was comprehensive and very informative. Thank you.
I was hoping you wouldn't notice.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.